here. Just.
House Committee on Revenue for May 20th, 2015 will come to order. I want to thank you for your indulgence with us working on our agenda, trying to figure out what's ready and what isn't ready. I wanted to announce that some plans that we have for the work session bills, there's a long list of them, and after I've announced the plans, we're going to open the public hearings at the top of the page. So let's just run down those. The work session on House Bill 3199 is going over to tomorrow. It's not ready. The work session on House Bill 2961 goes over to tomorrow. It's a little better, but it's still not ready. Senate Bill 36A is coming off of the agenda for now. We'll put it back on the agenda later. It's the technical fix bill. We're going to try to deal with that a little bit later. We're going to open and have a conversation about House Bill 2099. There's a new amendment that we want to talk about. We're going to open and talk about House Bill 2077, but neither of those bills is ready to move today. We're going to carry over until tomorrow. House Bill 3246 goes over till tomorrow. That one still needs some additional work. All three of the bills that we carried over from on the back side of the page, House Bill 2449, House Bill 2075, and House Bill 2818, all of those need some additional work, and they will all go over until tomorrow. Colleagues, as I warned you, a number of these bills we'll get to as they become ready, and we'll get them out as soon as we can, but this is a mechanism which allows us to do that. So now what I'd like to do, let's see, I've got some members here. Senator Whitsitt, which bill are you here for?
Oh, wait, hold on.
161, the top bill, so that's the one we'll open first. So with that, we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 161. Kyle is going to introduce it, and then we'll hear from the good senator.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 161 is a bill that's relating to business personal property taxes, and I think it's helpful to think of the bill almost in two component parts, one that relates to tax collectors and the Secretary of State, and then a second part that's relating to sellers of business and personal property and a bona fide purchaser provision. So starting with the portion that relates to the tax collectors and the Secretary of State, the measure would allow a county tax collector to electronically file warrants for delinquent property taxes on business personal property with the Secretary of State, who is then required to mark, hold, and index those filed warrants in accordance with the provisions of the Universal Commercial Code. It requires the tax collector to electronically file release or cancellation of the warrants with Secretary of State. The Secretary of State is to maintain a public access to the notices and cancellations, and it allows the Secretary of State to charge a fee for accepting the electronic notices. Excuse me, and allows the county tax collector to add the Secretary of State fee to the amount due on the warrant. The fee amount is not specified in the bill. It does specify the tax collector must still properly record the warrant, and it does provide that notice that the warrant expires after 10 years with Secretary of State, and it can also be extended for an additional 10 years in the UCC code. And then the second part of the bill is relating to requiring sellers of business personal property to provide a purchaser with disclosure notice that includes whether the property taxes were assessed against the property, if there's any liens against the property, or if there's other counties that have assessed tax against the property, or others who have had possession, control, or ownership of the property, and also a provision requiring explanation of the bona fide purchaser business personal property specification. It specifies bona fide business personal property purchaser is not liable for assessed taxes if purchased in good faith for value and at an arm's length transaction and without notice of delinquent taxes being outstanding on the property. And it does list the criteria for meeting without notice, allows the tax collector to accept equitable compromise payments on property from purchasers, and it does maintain the right to recovery against the former owner of the property.
Ah. Okay. Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Vega-Peterson, Vice Chair Benz, and the members of the committee. For the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsett, representing District 28, which is Klamath Lake, Crook, Deschutes, and Jackson counties. Thank you for taking the time to hear this bill. The problem that we are attempting to correct with Senate Bill 161 is seemingly somewhat simple. Under current law, Oregon personal property taxes follow the ownership of the property. In the event that the personal property tax is not paid, a personal property tax lien is attached to the personal property. That lien, as well as any accumulated penalties and interest, are payable by whomever owns the property. When a personal property lien is purchased, there is currently no existing adequate way for the purchaser to determine if an existing personal property tax lien is attached to that personal property when it's purchased. The tax lien may or may not be recorded in the county where the tax was incurred. And further, there is no method currently to search the other 35 Oregon counties for the existence of a personal property tax lien on that equipment. This situation almost always occurs during the purchase of a used business equipment. Under current law, once the personal property is acquired, the new owner is liable for all unpaid personal property taxes on the equipment, as well as all accumulated penalties and interest. An example might help to clarify the problem. For instance, a Lane County resident might purchase a metal lathe at auction in Deschutes County. The previous owner of the metal lathe is a resident of Malheur County, where he has failed to pay personal property taxes on the metal lathe. Malheur County has established a tax lien on the metal lathe. The property tax lien may or may not be properly recorded in Malheur County, but certainly is not recorded in either Deschutes or Lane County. Nevertheless, the new owner of the lathe incurs the liability to pay the unpaid personal property taxes as well as the accrued penalties and interest. As staff mentioned, the solution is a little more complex than the problem. We worked extensively with the Department of Revenue, the Secretary of State, county clerks, county tax collectors, and legislative council to craft this solution. So what Senate Bill 161 does, it creates a searchable property tax lien file in the office of the Secretary of State. It authorizes but does not require county tax collectors to file the personal property tax lien with the Secretary of State. It requires the seller of personal property to disclose unpaid personal property taxes or the existence of a personal property tax lien on the equipment if known. It requires the seller to disclose the previous ownership and location of the personal property if known. These conditions are similar to the disclosure required for the sale of real property, wherein known obligations and defects must be disclosed to the purchaser. It provides that a good faith search for tax lien fails to it provides that if a good faith search for tax lien fails to discover the tax lien, the purchaser falls under the bona fide purchaser provision and does not owe the back taxes, penalties, and interest. It provides that the owner of the property at the time the unpaid tax was levied remains liable to pay the taxes, interest, and penalties. The bill also authorizes partial settlement payments to be negotiated between the current owner and the county tax collector for less than the full amount of taxes, interest, and penalties owed. This currently is not allowed under law. However, regardless of any settlement agreement, the original owner, who failed to pay the personal property tax, remains liable to pay the back taxes, penalties, and interest. And finally, in the event that the tax collector is successful in tracking down the original debtor and is successful in collecting the full amount of the tax, interest, and penalties owed by the owner at that time the taxes were levied, any payment made in the negotiated settlement will be refunded to the taxpayer who settled. Mr. Chair, committee members, we believe that this bill resolves a longstanding inequity in Oregon tax law. No one should be forced to pay taxes incurred by someone else. Certainly, they should not be forced to pay those taxes when there is no adequate way to determine if taxes, interest, and penalties are owed prior to the purchase. This bill was passed out of both the Senate Judiciary and Senate Finance and Revenue Committees on a 5-0 vote. It passed the Senate on a 30-0 vote. The bill has a minimal fiscal impact as well as a minimal revenue impact. Mr. Chair, I would be remiss in not thanking Legislative Counsel Alan Dale for his exceptional effort in putting this measure together. We urge you to move this bill to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Senator Whitsitt? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. We'll call Diane Belt and Tammy Little, please. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today? This may be our only hearing. Okay.
Good afternoon. Chair Barnhart, committee members, for the record, my name is Diane Belt. I am the tax collection supervisor for Washington County, but today I am here representing the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors as their president. And I'd really like to thank Senator Whitsitt for taking this on. It was a good group that we had. A lot of the stakeholders were there. If ever we're going to come talk to you folks about a issue, it's going to be personal property. As tax collectors, it's probably not one of our most favorite taxes to collect, mainly because of the fact it is a personal debt as well as a lien against the equipment, which is a lot different than real property, which is in rem, in that it's against the property itself. So what happens with personal property is there's a little bit of a different type of a collection action. Because it is a personal debt, that means that we can do things like garnishments. There, when we record our warrant, a lien attaches against all of their assets. So that's one avenue of collection. Another avenue is to actually go seize the property and sell it. So what ends up happening is, in a situation that the senator explained, is you have business owner A sells to business owner B. Business owner B doesn't make his payments. He gives it back to business owner A. Business owner C sells it, moves it out of the county. They always go and they look at the UCC recordings and they find that, oh, there's no UCC filing, so we're good. But we don't record with UCC. We record our warrants with the county clerk. I cannot personally make that owner responsible for that debt because they didn't possess it on January 1 of the assessment year. So my avenue is to seize the property and sell it. So in essence, we are kind of making them responsible for that debt. We have a bona fide purchaser process for real property. We've never had one for business personal property, and I've always wondered why. This creates that. We support it wholeheartedly. I've always thought we should record our warrant in the UCC recording. This solves that problem. So the two big takeaways from this bill, in my estimation, is it gives the tax collector a few more tools. Plus, it also helps the business owner so that they know where they need to go look to find these things out. Because it's not very fun when you have an assessment on a property on January 1. It sells two or three times before the bill comes out. And then they call us and they want to know, what is this back tax? And, well, bingo. Well, we checked UCC. We don't record in UCC. So then it's not a real, it's sometimes it can be a business killer, and we don't like to have to be the bearer of bad news, but ultimately our job is to collect that tax and to enforce compliance. So we are excited about this because it does help the business community, it helps the taxpayer, and it also helps us as the collectors to give us a little more leniency on how we deal with these issues. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barnhart and committee members, for the record, my name is Tammy Little. I'm the Assessment and Taxation Manager at the Clackamas County Assessor's Office. But today I'm here representing the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors as the first vice president. I'm in support of Senate Bill 161, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify. The first point that I'd like to make is that this is a hardship for a new business owner when they discover delinquent property taxes that are a lien on the equipment they just purchased. And in my experience, they typically will ask us, why didn't you file in the UCCs with the Secretary of State's, because that Secretary of State, because that's where they did their due diligence. So Senate Bill 161 would help resolve that. I also believe it would be good for business and good for all stakeholders involved. The tax collectors, it would allow them to have an additional collection tool to be able to file this lien in the UCCs. in addition to the warrant that we record with the county clerk, and really that just helps make this lien more accessible to everyone. The last point I'd like to make is that I agree with the creation of the bona fide purchaser process for business personal property. It's very much needed. I concur with Diane. It gives them the same rights that people who purchase real property have. So, again, I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to say thank you for all the work, and thank the Senator for all his work in the transactions I've managed back in Eastern Oregon. This problem has come up repeatedly, and so it's wonderful to have a solution to it. So I really appreciate your taking the time and all the effort that was made to get to this point.
Thank you.
Okay. This bill actually sets up a new registry in the Secretary of State's office, and you've worked with the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of State's happy with it.
Chair Barnhart, yes, we have been working with the Secretary of State. We've sent copies of the documents. It's an addition to the warrant. Still has to be recorded with the county clerk because right. That sets up some of our legal collection actions. But what it does, there's my friend. but what it does for us, hopefully for a nominal fee, is it, and it's not a requirement. I probably wouldn't use this process on a $300 tax bill, but I would on a $1,000 or $2,000 tax bill.
Right. Thank you. Secretary of State.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Peter Threlka with the Secretary of State's office. It won't actually be a new filing. There is a new filing type. We would refer to it, we'll call it a county warrant. And it's modeled after IRS liens, revenue warrants that we currently file for the Department of Revenue. So it'll be a very similar process for us. It's just to basically recreate an existing process or a filing that we already do using the existing UCC system with our online search engine, with our online filing engine. So it's we're going to utilize all the resources that we have currently today. So from our perspective, this is a very simple, easy bill to implement, and we think it'll have a good outcome.
Thank you. So if somebody checks the UCC filings and one of these warrants is recorded, it will pop up.
That is correct.
So that's why we've been calling it a UCC filing, even though it really isn't.
Correct. Yeah. There's actually probably a half dozen different programs that are in the that we term as UCC, yeah. But they all utilize that UCC system. You do a debtor name search, and if there's any match, they'll all come up.
Right. Other questions for the Secretary of State or the tax collectors? I would simply note that in our meeting materials, there's a letter from Mountain Embroidery. It's the very first item at the bottom of the page, Sharon and Larry Rydell describing their experience that they described to the Senate Committee on Judiciary. I just finished reading that, and it describes perfectly the dilemma that a purchaser, a bona fide innocent mm-hmm. purchaser, falls into in one of these tax situations. Thank you. Yes, Representative Benz.
So the burden now, given that we're extending the bona fide purchaser status, the burden shifts to whom, just in your opinion, to make sure the lien is of record and all of that? Who now is on the risk?
Well, Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, the way the bona fide purchaser process is going to work is there's going to be a form that's going to be developed that the seller of the property will give to the purchaser. And it will say, I swear, all tax liens are paid. As the purchaser, their requirement then is to check with the county in which they think it may be located and to also check with UCC. So as long as they've done that and then a tax bill comes up because maybe it was a $300 bill that I did not record a UCC on, I have an easy way to cancel that debt and hold them harmless as a bona fide purchaser that did their due process.
Thank you.
Is the fee for recording going to be similar to the other filings in the same database?
Chair Bernhardt, we were actually setting this up a little bit differently. We were able to work with the committee and legislative council. What we're going to be doing is a more of a subscription fee, software as a service based model. So we don't intend to develop or charge a fee to the counties during the first biennium that this is in effect. We'll consider that probably in the 2017-2019 biennium. It would be by rule. Right now, if I had to hazard a guess, I would say we would look to charge $500 a year, but we'll separate the filing transaction from the cost of hosting this service for them, and that reduces, that keeps my costs down. I don't have staff or labor that are involved in having to do the filings because they're all electronic, and we can just send an invoice once a year. They can write a check. At $15 per filing, the break-even point is 34 filings a year. So anything that's over and above that, and I know in Diane's County, they do 500 liens a year, something like that. Yeah, so actually works out to, if they're filing a lot of those, and it should be a simple process so that the unit costs will be very low.
Do you have capacity for batch filing?
We don't currently, but we have experience with that, and we do know, and from talking to the counties, that I think it's 33 utilize the same computer system database, and that would be something that we'd definitely want to look at, that we could get system to system and just let them automatically write to our UCC application. That would be a a very nice efficient improvement to put into place. We just we'll have that conversation after we get going.
Sure. That $300 limit then may not be terribly important if you can just upload a data file with 35 or 40 or 500 items in it.
Yeah. Chair Bernhardt, just to let you know, every warrant that we record, we have to charge $102 per document for the recording and the release. So this is very exciting to us to be able to do it for a very nominal fee and to also, you know, assist the taxpayers in ensuring that they're not buying something with a lien. Mm-hmm. And the case that you talked about, it's very typical. And, you know, as a tax collector, it's really hard for us to have to say, I'm sorry, but the law doesn't really give us the latitude to compromise the tax. So this is very, very helpful.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 161. Mm-hmm. Colleagues, are you ready to work this bill? Okay, we'll open the work session on Senate Bill 161. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 161 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Benz moves Senate Bill 161 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? I would simply like to thank the good senator and the people who worked on this proposal. This is the kind of streamlining and repairing that actually simplifies our regulatory and tax system that I think will be of great benefit to the people of Oregon, and we need to do lots of it all in lots of different places. Thank you very much. Is any other discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. And the bill goes to the floor. I'm looking at the bill, and it looks to me.
I'll carry it.
Oh, thank you. Representative Whitsitt will carry. I was wondering if that was going to be the case. I noticed that the other sponsors of the bill were you and Representative Gomberg. So Representative Whitsitt will carry, and with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 161. Thank you, Senator. Appreciate it. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 864. And you're here on that one, too. Oh, okay. Good. I wondered why these got bunched the way they did. Now I know.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Senate Bill 864 comes to you also from the other side than from the Senate Finance and Revenue, what it became an A. Senate Bill 864 deals with an issue that used to be our favorite perennial issue, the state tax and the credit for natural resource properties. As you recall, in the 2011, the Oregon Law Commission have helped to craft, at that time, House Bill 2541, where we built an independent, standalone type of estate tax that does not depend on the federal code except with the definitions in the federal code, and everything else we have built on in the statutes of Oregon, where you have the rates and the schedules and the definitions of what is and what is not taxable under that statute. We have now a schedule that ramps up rather than jumps, as a previous one when it was connected to the federal code. And this ramping up goes from 10% tax rate to 16%. Now, there is a natural resource credit built into that system, and this was designed at the time of, well, it started at 2007, and then it went on to be improved and changed until now it has the a proportion. We built it as a proportion of what the at a $7.5 million price, if you will, $7.5 million cap, and those definitions of what qualifies and what doesn't, and what comes in, whether it's an operating capital or otherwise, all are in defined in the proportion of the denominator and not in numerator. And this bill, what it actually did is paid attention that the denominator and the numerator were referencing slightly different definition of where these properties are. And that reference did not distinguish whether those properties were in or outside of Oregon. And therefore, we made this adjustment on the Senate side to make the denominator and numerator of the proportion consistent, and only to reference the states that are actually within the borders of the state. That's the bill in front of you.
Very good. Senator, welcome back.
Thank you, Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee. Once again, for the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsett, representing District 28, Klamath Lake, Crook, Deschutes, and Jackson counties. Thanks for hearing this bill. Senate Bill 864 corrects what I believe is an inadvertent flaw in the Oregon Chapter 118. That law has allowed the Oregon Department of Revenue, or actually compelled them, they believe, to interpret the law in a manner that deprives Oregon Natural Resources states of a credit that was intended by the Legislative Assembly. Under ORS 118-140, an estate is allowed a credit toward the estate tax based on the value of certain natural resources property. However, this credit is available only if the total value of the natural resource property in the state makes up at least 50% of the total adjusted gross estate. What I believe was a drafting flaw in 118-140 is that it includes no site limitation on the real property. The current statute provides that real property for the purpose of the natural resource credit is limited to property that is located in Oregon. But the statute defines gross estate for the purpose of the estate tax by adopting the definition used in the federal tax code. That definition includes all property wherever that property is located. Therefore, for the purpose of the current statute, real property must be located within Oregon in order to fall within the definition of natural resource property that is eligible for the state tax credit. this drafting aberration in the original statute allows the Oregon Department of Revenue to deny the estate tax credit to farmers, ranchers, foresters, and fishers who own property in adjoining states when the ownership of that property owned in an adjoining state reduces the percentage of natural resources property that is located in Oregon to less than 50% of the total gross estate. Senate Bill 864 corrects that statutory flaw by defining real property for the purpose of the Oregon estate tax to mean that the total value of natural resources property in the estate is at least 50% of the total adjusted gross estate that is located in Oregon. For example, a Klamath County rancher may also own ranch property in California. The Department of Revenue believes that they are compelled to deny the estate its natural resource credit when the value of the ranch property located in Oregon is less than 50% of the gross value of the entire state located in both Oregon and California. Senate Bill 864 passed out of Senate Finance and Revenue Committee on a 5-0 vote, passed the Senate on a 30-0 vote. Mr. Chair, no one should be unfairly penalized in Oregon's tax code due to a drafting error that deprives them of a tax credit that is available to other Oregonians only because their property extends across the state border. We urge you to send Senate Bill 864 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Good bill.
Representative Smith Warner.
Well, I'm just trying. So, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator, for bringing this forward. So, and I was trying to read quickly through this. So, this has been an issue since it was initially put into statute. It looks like the late 90s, early 2000s. Am I reading that correctly, or did I skim too quickly?
I believe this bill was, correct me please, Representative Benz, if I'm wrong, but it was put into place in 2011.
Oh. The first bill that Representative Benz was asked to work on when he got here in the middle of some session by the then chair of the Revenue Committee was the first of the bills that had to do with the natural resources estate tax exemption. Do you recall that? I'm sure.
Mr. Chair, I think it was passed in 07. I got here in 08.
In 08.
To help with the first fix. The first, right.
And this is about the fifth or sixth fix, I think, yeah, on this bill. But we actually started it. Thank you for the reminder. We actually started it in 2007. And the idea was, at that point, was that we didn't want to force family farmers off the farm when the owner died. If the farm was their major asset, and that's why we have these rules about the 50% of the estate and that kind of thing. It wasn't intended to benefit Bill Gates, who happens to own a hobby farm somewhere in Oregon. I don't know if he does or not, but it wasn't intended to help him. It was intended to help these farm families, and we're learning one more wrinkle about it today. Mm-hmm. This has been a long and illustrious history, hasn't it? Mazin has worked on all of them. And I'm smiling a little because it took us a long time to figure out how to actually do it in a way that actually reached the goal we had in mind, which was to preserve the estate tax, which we desperately need to help pay for schools, and at the same time not force family farmers off the farm.
Because just on the face of it, the idea of making sure that the property that you're dealing with is primarily in Oregon, that on the face of it, that seems reasonable. And so the point of this, though, is that you're talking about contiguous pieces, mostly in kind of on the southern and eastern, and maybe, well, no, nobody's really going to have a on the northern, where there's contiguous property that spans
in the Klamath Basin, I think, is what you're talking about.
Yeah, specifically, but this could be an issue in eastern Oregon as well.
Sure.
So.
Chair Barnhart, to respond to you, to Representative Smith Warner's question, it can be contiguous properties. Often in the Klamath Basin, ranchers own property in, say, Fort Klamath, and where they run their cattle in the summertime, and in near Red Bluff, where they run their cattle in the wintertime. Under the current law, this could all be a natural resource estate, but if the estate of the property that's owned in California is 51% of the state, of the value of the state, the credit for the Oregon part of the state would disappear because of the way that the law is written. And that's what I'm sure that's not what was intended.
Okay, thank you.
Right, I think that's right. The question I had was what about that hobby farm where the assets of a very large estate are mostly elsewhere, but somebody's taken a hankering to some small river or something in Oregon and has bought a farm and is working it, and so the only asset in Oregon is that farm, which would under the normal rule qualify for natural resources property, but the estate is worth many, many times that amount, all of which is out of state. Of course, that was not the farm that we were intending to protect. How does this bill treat that situation? Can you tell us?
That's a good question. I think most of those hobby farms that you're discussing would already fall under the minimum estate tax, the minimum threshold. This one then would extend that to those people who actually work the ranch for a living to up to that a higher limit.
Thank you. That was, yes.
There's also, if you recall, we've put a number of conditions in the natural resource idea to one of those are look back and look forward into material participation. So
right.
You have to be an actual material participating in the natural resource business before you qualify for that natural resource credit. So these are the different steps that you have to go through before you actually qualify.
So the rancher that he refers to in the Klamath Valley definitely meets the participation standard.
Because that's the business.
The rich guy from New York does not. Thank you. It's amazing how passage of time deprives one of the recollection of the stuff that we painfully worked on back when. But I think that we're sufficiently covered. We have additional witnesses, and unless there are more questions for Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Katie Fast, Lyndon Kearns, Roger Beyer, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau. Oregon Farm Bureau supports Senate Bill 864A, and the reason why we're bringing it forward is we have had a handful of members contact us that they were disqualified to utilize the credit because they operated in two states. Their main operation based in Oregon, but it's very common, and probably the majority of farms are not contiguous, and they have fields and parcels that are spread amongst different areas, counties, and sometimes states. And in some of those cases, you had that the base Oregon value was maybe not over 50% when you added in the out-of-state parcel. And also you have to remember that gross estate is also other holdings that may or may not be within agriculture. And so when you take that contiguous amount, they sometimes in very small situations, but significant situations for those families, they were disqualified because they didn't have 51% of their holdings in state. So the changes that this bill brings to the credit is how that qualifier is calculated. It takes that gross amount of real property and has it based on in-state real property. And then the natural resource figure that is divided on that has to equal 51% or more to qualify, that has to be the Oregon-based portion of the property. It is the fix that was decided upon in the Senate after some discussion on the bill and was amended to be in. It has minimal fiscal impact. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. And Mr. Kearns has a family from Klamath who is actually impacted by this.
Great. Who would like to go next?
Go ahead.
Mr. Kearns? Yeah, thank you for coming all the way up here to talk to us. Appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm Chair Barnhart. My name's Lyndon Kearns. I'm from Clown Falls. We have a farming there for four generations, Century Farm. In the 1950s, we run cattle. We bought property down at Elk Creek, California, which is about 250 miles south, so we're not contiguous at all. So we run our cattle in Clown County in the summer and then ship them south in the winter and winter range them down there. Anyway, so in 2012, my grandmother passed away, so the estate was, of course, handed down to my father and my aunt. And anyway, part of the problem we ran into, thought, well, you know, that's all we do is farm. And you figured, well, this will help, you know, when we're passing on to help reduce that tax bill. Well, we come to find out we didn't qualify because we had almost 3,000 acres in California, even though it's winter range lands, not prime farmlands, up and down, brushy stuff. Still, the value of it was way over what the value of per portion of the Oregon estate was. So we consequently, like you mentioned, the 50%, we got kicked out of that. So we were unable to use a natural resource credit, which, you know, my aunt, who's an 80-year-old lady, had to go borrow money to pay her part of the bill and is still paying on that. You know, that's not easy for a lady that age. You know, so I would urge the committee that support this bill because there is other families I know that have been doing this for generations. And we were probably the first or one of the first actually ran into this. So anyway, that's kind of our story.
Thank you very much. Mr. Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Byer. I'm here representing the Oregon Seed Council, the Oregon Dairy Farmers, and the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, all of which support this bill. This bill, as you've already heard from a real-life example and from others, is very important or can be very important to family operations as they're trying to move forward after the death of a loved one. I'll just touch on a couple points. Some questions were asked about are there protections in the bill that will keep Bill Gates or Phil Knight or someone from owning a small parcel and then using this as a qualifier. You will notice, as I read it on the bottom of page 2, near the bottom of page 2, that the total gross value of the state can't exceed $15 million before this can be used. There's one protection right there. There's another protection. If you look on the top of page 3, there's actually two protections there, one of which that the property had to have been used as a farm, forest, ranch, or fishing properties for 5 of the 8 years preceding the death of the family member, and that must be continued to be used for 5 out of the 8 years following the death of the family member. So there are some good safeguards built into the law. This one small, and I agree with Senator Woods, this was an oversight in drafting, I think. It was never intended that if a person, whether it's contiguous property or not, that if it's property is used in Oregon for the purposes of farming, ranching, fishing, the intent was that this credit could apply to the properties in Oregon. So with this simple little fix, adding, I think, 5 words a couple places in the statute and setting an implementation date, it will fix that moving forward, and I think hopefully it will be good to go for a while further. I'd like to thank the chair for entertaining this bill. We had a conversation a few months back about how you would ask me how this fix had been working, and I brought this to your attention at that point in time and pointed out there was a Senate bill pending, and thank you for agreeing to look at it when it got here and you know, moving it forward now. So, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? I would simply note, Mr. Byer, that you're absolutely right. The issue of a farm like Mr. Kearns' farm never came up. We never talked about an issue that would have involved farmland in two different states in one operating farm, which is in effect what his is. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you. This is a fix, and I had forgotten all of the safeguards we'd built into this thing, and we're not changing any of those, are we?
No, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Anything else for this panel? Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on Senate Bill 864? There is.
Chair Barnhart, Jim Welsh, representing Oregon Cattlemen, and we just wanted to thank you for certainly bringing this this forward, this bill, to the committee, and we wanted to thank the sponsors for, you know, representing those that we've been talking about here. We certainly support this, and we hope that you will move this on to be passed on the floor. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 864. You're ready to work this bill? I think so. All right. We'll open the work session on Senate Bill 864. Discussion about the bill? It seems pretty straightforward. Representative Vance?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 864 to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Vance moves Senate Bill 864A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, it's so ordered. I'm looking at the sponsor list. Representative Whitsitt, are you interested in carrying this one as well?
Maybe Rep. Clem and I could do that together.
Why don't you and Rep. Clem carry it? And if he doesn't want to, we could find you a different carrier, because I notice also the Representative Boone and Representative Krieger are on this bill.
Would Rep. Benz like to do it since he's worked on it so long, or would he prefer that I do?
Okay, sure. The two of you carry it together?
Sure.
Okay, we'll do it that way. Representative Whitsitt and Representative Benz will carry, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 864. Thank you. Now I'd like to open the work session on House Bill 2099. I will note, colleagues, that it's not ready to move yet, but we do have some additional news that we'd like to pass along. And Paul, that's yours? Yeah. In a stepwise process, we're getting closer and closer to actually getting this bill ready.
We are moving asymptotically toward the...
Asymptotically. Toward the, yes. We're into big words today. Please.
That means we never get there. Then,
oh, that's the problem, isn't it?
That's the downside.
That's the dilemma of the tortoise and the hare and the halfway to the goal,
yes,
thing.
That's
isn't
right.
It?
You get halfway each time.
I remember.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we discussed the dashed 4 amendment yesterday to House Bill 2099. Today you have the dash 6. And the dash 6 amendment does not make substantive changes to the dash 4. It corrects a number of issues that we saw in the first draft of the dash 4. We just got this, by the way, about 1 o'clock. And as we went through, I asked the Department of Revenue to go through this, and they pointed out a number of things. And I'll just kind of update you on the changes. One of the things that the Dash 4 did was to eliminate the Netherlands Antilles, because that was no longer a political union. But it did not add back in the states that were part of the Antilles. And so those show up as... those states are listed now within the dash 6. So there's a total of 5 of them, 5 island nations that get added as a result of that. It does add Panama, which we which was in the dash 4 from the original 2013 list. The dash 4 did not eliminate Monaco, and the dash 6 does. All of these changes are make the bill itself consistent with the Department of Revenue report to you. So that was the reasoning behind those changes, was to make it consistent. One of the things, the policy change that you looked at yesterday was around what to do with income that's reported in a listed jurisdiction that does not have a U.S. origin. And that was one of the policy concerns that we tried to fix in the dash 4s, and the dash 6 amendments is very similar. It's on page 2, section 2, sub 2. Most all of that is the same, and we think that this is workable. We've talked to corporations that are affected by it, and we think that this does resolve the issue of non-source U.S. income winding up being reported in a jurisdiction and coming back to Oregon. That's the policy idea, is to avoid that from happening, because the intent is to get a more accurate portrayal of what the water's edge U.S. income is. The only language change here is on line 6. There was a subtracted, and we changed that to eliminated. Just thought that was more clear. We had concerns about subtracted from a negative, two negatives, and how that might be interpreted by the taxpayer. So that becomes eliminated rather than subtracted. The other changes are that, as you recall, one of the criticisms of the current law is that it just lists the jurisdictions but does not give any set of criteria for them being on the list. So we added that. So this bill, the dash 4, now the dash 6, will add that to the statute. Starting on page 4 there, under section 4, you can see the listings. The problem with the dash 4 was that those were kind of summaries of those listings. What we put in there now was the actual language that came from the Multi-State Tax Commission. So, and this language has been adopted by some states that are looking at this issue too. So you have a clear statutory reference there in terms of why these particular jurisdictions are on this list. So those are the main changes. The other change we did in terms of implementation, and this is primarily for administrative ease purposes, we had this kind of a staggered start date, some provisions starting in 15, some in 16. New version would have all the provisions starting on January 1 of 2016, so for the 2016 corporate tax year. And we thought this would give the department time to prepare and also taxpayers time to prepare, and it would be a consistent starting date for all these provisions. So those are the changes. The revenue impact is slightly more from this. I haven't had a chance to work that up yet, but overall, the impact, the overall impact we expected, very similar to what you saw in the dash 4 statement.
Okay. Thank you. If you have questions, now would be a great time. But of course, obviously, we'll have a time to do that later when we actually have the paperwork and are ready to work the bill. At this stage, I think what I need to do is take this latest draft back and read it carefully and think about it, and I suspect other members need to do the same. But we also wanted to make it available to the public in case others wanted to comment on it, either to individual members or later on to the committee. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Paul, the concern some of us have expressed is that there will be an undue burden put upon them to prove that which they didn't, that which is not appropriately treated as originating in Oregon. Perhaps you can take us through, first of all, what you think they would have to show, and then secondly, what you think the cost might be to one of these multinational corporations in doing that. In other words, the burdens placed upon them once they're found to be doing business in this country to come forward and say, unless you show us otherwise, we're going to include this income, a portion of it, in your Oregon income for tax purposes. And they then say, wow, that's going to be very expensive to prove, or we don't want to have to do it. I'm not sure which, maybe both. But can you share with us your best take on what it's going to cost these folks to perhaps prove something they'd rather not have to?
Okay. Well, Vice Chair Benz, Mr. Chair, I think we did have kind of some input from Department of Revenue yesterday, and Joe DeNicola is here today as well for any follow-up. But I think the point is that, as Joe pointed out yesterday, one of the real driving ideas behind the 2013 legislation, while it had a certain kind of a blunt approach, it was administratively very straightforward. If you had an affiliate that was part of a unitary group that had income reported in jurisdiction X, then you had to add that back on your Oregon return. And then you could adjust that for the sales you have in that jurisdiction. So that was a very straightforward thing. Now, I think the drawback of that from a policy standpoint is you may end up picking up income that isn't sourced to the U.S. So originally. So that brings in this subtraction, or what we're now calling an elimination, of this source income. My sense of this is that corporations will have this information, that the corporate tax returns these are complicated and large for these multinational corporations. We're dealing with, when you look at the amount of reported U.S. affiliate income abroad, you're dealing with a very small subsect of subsector of U.S. corporations. These are the very big global corporations. So they're large corporations with large accounting staff. They have to deal with individual states, individual countries. So I suspect the reporting requirements would not be severe. And as Joe pointed out from the Department of Revenue, they would anticipate being able to implement this with, let's say, a minimal fiscal impact on them. So I think the data is there. I think that the nature of corporate income taxes is always complicated, and that is certainly one of the drawbacks of corporate income taxes in general. But I wouldn't see this as adding a large additional complexity to it.
Well, so if we include in their income here in Oregon, for Oregon purposes, all of the income from, let's say, Netherlands, and then they need to come in and show what it is they can reduce that number by. What is it that they can put in as items to deduct from that income? What is it? I think you said sales. But let's assume that the money in the Netherlands is in the billions and their sales are 200,000. What else could they bring in to show to reduce that number?
Well, I think the other issue revolves around the subtraction or the elimination. So this is where you get to, you've reported that income from your subsidiaries there. What you have to have, the next step, is evidence that income that was reported in the Netherlands, or whatever the listed jurisdiction is, did not originate from the U.S., that it originated from anywhere else other than the U.S., from Germany or from China or wherever it originated from. Then you would have to indicate that. You would have to have evidence that that's where it indicated from, and therefore did not have a U.S. origin.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much, Paul. I understand we're not going to work this today, but as we get closer, if we have another hearing, would it be possible to do one of those lovely examples, as Paul did, I think in the first or second hearing this year on the subject, that integrates the changes reflected in this amendment? I think this is probably the only sort of thing I will only understand in the context of an example. And even then, it will be pushing the limits.
Well, one of the things we've already learned about this topic is that it's an iterative process.
Yes.
Just like the Senate bill we just heard.
Yes.
We are very unlikely to get it right the first two or three tries. To get it all right.
Yeah.
But I think what you're suggesting makes a lot of sense to me. There are several different kinds of companies.
Yeah.
One kind of company is a company that has some sales in Oregon, but most of its business is in one of the listed countries. And therefore their sales in that other country would be very substantial.
Mm-hmm.
Demonstrating that, and they're done. They've really basically reduce their whole situation. Another business may have some sales in that other country, but also sell all over the world. If they can show what their sales are in other parts of the world, then they can deduct that piece too. My suspicion also is that the kinds of income that we're after, royalty income and those kinds of things, where basically there aren't sales involved, we're mostly talking about intellectual property and other similar things, the number of transactions, not the size, but the number, is pretty small, probably. I can't imagine that they would be paying a royalty per sale, but rather it would be on a bulk activity. And therefore, we're talking about one transaction a year, or maybe a month. So the number of transactions that would be involved that would actually be subject to our concern would be pretty small. Is that accurate, Paul, do you think?
I think so, Mr. Chair. I think it's important to recognize that it's really income that we're after here at this first stage.
Right.
We want to know where that income originated from. And then the sales factor comes into the portion that share back to Oregon.
Right.
But, you know, I think the way that we've talked about this issue and looked at it, and as we did 2 years ago, our system was built around a water's edge, that it's just the income reported in the United States. So, and that allows us to go back to the federal return, the consolidated return. Still have reference to it here in this amendment. So you've got the consolidated return, and our interpretation of the policy of the legislature was we really want to maintain that general approach to corporate income. However, there are exceptions to it, and those exceptions are based on what we know about the activities in these listed jurisdictions. So we're saying we have a water's edge approach, and we have an appendage on that, which is the income that's reported in these jurisdictions, and we spell those out, recognizing that once you report income there, you can also report the sales and therefore make a smaller amount apportioned back. So now this step here with a Section 2 adjustment, we're saying, okay, we're reporting, we're adding these jurisdictions back in, but then we're saying, but wait a minute, we may have overcounted what's really U.S. source income. So you're making an adjustment on an adjustment. So you still have the water's edge, but you've added this appendage of these additional jurisdictions, and then you're trying to further refine that by pulling out that income that really is not sourced to the U.S. but to somewhere else. So that's the whole mechanism of how it works. Now, I'd be happy to drop some examples which shows goes through the where the income's reported, what the apportionment is, and then show how an elimination or subtraction might look.
That'd be very helpful.
So. I think it would. I think it would, too. Other comments, questions today? Thank you. Well, with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2099. Let's see. And we're... We have. Did you want to have a conversation on 2077? Chris has an amendment.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll open the work session on House Bill 2077. Again, colleagues, this is not one that we're actually ready to work today, but we want to talk about an amendment proposal. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong person when I looked over on that one. Chris?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In all this, or
go ahead.
For House Bill 2077, in all this, there is a -3 amendment that is effectively the changes that were discussed that I mentioned yesterday. And there's actually a -4 that just appeared.
Uh-oh.
I'm not sure where that came from.
Nice. From me.
My guess is there was a...
Is it yours?
I think I have a guess as to where it came from. In the -3, there was an extra word address that is missing from the -4, so I think Ledge Council caught something. So at the risk of making a fool of myself, I'll walk through the -4. So the changes here, again, just kind of reiterating yesterday, in Section 1... Lines 7 through 9, there is the sentence, the information submitted should be obtained from the most recent version of the tax return filed with the department as of the date of submission. This is just clarifying that it's a technical clarification for which version of the data the Department of Revenue would submit to the Legislative Revenue Office. As the committee is aware, corporations will file a return. There might be an amended return or there might be an audited return. And this just indicates for the ease of administration of this in complying with this law, it would be the information that they have as of the date that the report is due. Then the other changes, just kind of walking through the amendment on lines 15 through 17, clarify that it is limited to C corporations that are subject to the excise tax under Chapter 317
and have an apportionment percentage of less than 100%, basically your multi-state corporations. Lines 21 through 22 limit the disclosure of the term liability to the excise tax liability under Chapter 317. And then moving to page 2 on line 4, that refers to the taxpayer's Oregon sales. That just makes that reference consistent with line 14 on the same page. So this is the Oregon sales reported on the tax return. Mm-hmm. Line 15 added the word Oregon to clarify that it's the Oregon taxable income. And then in line 21, the words described in replaced in violation of, just to clarify that it's just the information listed in there without referring to criminal activity. And then section 2 is new, and it would require, it moves it out 1 year, so that the first year that the report would be due would be 2016. And I mentioned yesterday that that part of the reason for doing that was in the fall of 2016, the department will be rolling out the personal income tax program within the GenTax system. Another relevant piece, that, which I didn't mention yesterday, is that by moving it out to this date, then all of the data required by the report would be within the GenTax system. They wouldn't if they were to do it now, they would have to go to their old system, which would be problematic. So moving it out 1 year adds some consistency with the source of the information. So all of those changes were those that were discussed yesterday. And so the dash 3 just has them all listed out for you.
Very good. Representative Davis, did you have something?
The dash 4, thank you, Chair, adds one element, which are lines 18 and 19.
Of page 1?
I'm sorry, on page 2.
Page 2.
Oh, there it is.
Okay, so 3 and 4 are identical except for lines 18 and 19 on the dash 4. Is that what you're saying?
That's my understanding, yeah.
Okay. Can we check the feasibility of that to see whether that's something that we can ask the department to easily, to readily do?
Yeah, I can look into that.
Because it's a very intriguing idea. And it does fill out the picture, doesn't it, Representative Davis?
Indeed.
One of the principles that we use when we're comparing our taxes to taxes in another state is we don't look at any one tax. We look at them all put together. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you can't make a comparison that makes any sense.
And, right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so you have your late night work to do yes. with those two simple lines.
Two lines anyway, Mr. Chair.
Hmm. Sorry?
Two lines anyway, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And now I'll go through it to see if there are any other changes.
Right. Yes. But the dash 3 does everything that you described, doesn't it?
Yeah, the dash 3 does have, on line page 1, line 14, there's an extra word address. The report required under this section shall address, and then just grammatically, I think they would clean that up. And that was cleaned up in the dash 4.
I see. Okay. So if we decided to leave out the extra two lines, we would need a dash 5 that deals with the word address.
Possibly. Yeah. I can check with the Ledge Council. That seems okay. Like something they could clean up upon engrossing the bill.
Okay. All right. Okay. Is there any other discussion of this bill today? All right. Well, with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2077. And colleagues, in case I didn't say it, we're going to hold over both House Bill 2077 and House Bill 2099 to tomorrow. Again, no promises that we'll actually work them tomorrow, but we'll have a status update report. And Paul, you've been keeping track of my announcements. Do I need to make any more? I think I've made them all. I mean, my intention is to hold over all of the bills that were listed under work session, except for Senate Bill 36, which we're just taking off for now. And, of course, Senate Bill 161 and Senate Bill 864 are out.
Mr. Chair, Paul Warner, let's say Revenue Office. The one that I don't have marked is 3199, your first one, if you wanted to try to carry that over or have us repost that for next week. My understanding is we're still a few strides away from having something.
You think there's no chance of being ready tomorrow?
That's my understanding.
All right. So we can carry that over till Tuesday?
We could.
Or you can post for Tuesday.
I can post for Tuesday.
I want to encourage the Treasury to get going on this bill.
Actually, I can't post for Tuesday because it's only 24 hours. Monday doesn't count. So why don't we just carry it over?
Let's carry it over. Okay. We'll carry it over until Tuesday next week. All the other bills that are on that list, we are carrying over till tomorrow.
Okay.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Great. We'll do that. Anything else today? I apologize, committee, for all the complexities, but some of these just need to get worked, and it's going to take a little bit more time. With that, committee is adjourned. See you tomorrow.